From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast. On the night of the 21st of March, Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal was arrested by the Enforcement Directorate in connection with the Delhi liquor policy case, in which his deputy was arrested earlier.
Chief Minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, has now been arrested by the Enforcement Directorate. In a short while from now, Arvind Kejriwal will be taken out from here, taken to the Enforcement Directorate headquarters.
The Delhi Chief Minister is the first Chief Minister to be arrested while in office. Despite his arrest, Kejriwal has stayed the Chief Minister of the city-state for now. Earlier in January, Jharkhand Chief Minister Hemant Soren resigned days before he was arrested by the Enforcement Directorate for his involvement in an alleged land scam. What's common to both these leaders is the fact that they're both leaders of parties that are part of the opposition coalition India. As it stands, there's little clarity on whether either of these leaders will be able to lead their respective parties' campaigns in the upcoming Lok Sabha elections. Professor Suhas Palshikar is one of India's most eminent political scientists and has been a vocal critic of Kejriwal's arrest. Professor Palshikar is the chief editor of the journal Studies in Indian Politics and is the co-director of Lokneeti, an organization dedicated to studying electoral politics in India. In today's episode, Professor Palshikar explains why he considers these arrests as indecent in a democracy and why he thinks they create an atmosphere that is unsuitable for democracy. He spoke with my colleague Alka Dhupkar and me about what these arrests reveal about the ruling BJP as well. Alka started by asking him why he views the arrest of Arvind Kejriwal as a threat to Indian democracy.
So Arvind Kejriwal is going to stay in ED custody till March 28. This is the second chief minister being arrested in 2 months and the first arrest after the code of conduct is issued. You have analyzed this arrest as a threatening message to the Indian democracy. We would like to know, why do you think so?
See, this is because it is not just about Arvind Kejriwal or one chief minister, but the idea that a chief minister is arrested. And in the course of this discussion, I would say again and again that I am not interested in the merits of the case against Mr. Arvind Kejriwal. The point is that if you are arresting a chief minister, what is the timing that is chosen for that? If the investigating agencies are so sure that he is involved in it, then will there be an immediate trial? Suppose Arvind Kejriwal says tomorrow start the trial. Will the investigating agencies start the trial? They will ask for time, which means that the adage process is punishment applies to this case. And look at Mr. Hemant Soren. After 2 months, the trial has not started, which then means that the investigating agencies are not sure what they want to actually say. But at the same time, as it is called, a fishing expedition is done. You arrest people left and right, put them in jail, get their custody and hurt the opposition. That is why I thought that this is something indecent in a democracy.
Bail or jail, whatever happens with him in next hearing, will it help Kejriwal building his campaign in future?
Generally, my sense is that Aam Aadmi Party and Kejriwal have not been very successful in spreading beyond a very limited circle of people or beyond a very limited geographical locale. As a result of that, much of his and AAP's supporters are also BJP supporters. There is no division between them. There is no separation of the two. And therefore, I think currently what will happen is that the BJP would take over his support base rather than Kejriwal being able to capitalize on that. There isn't much sympathy for Kejriwal outside of his very core base in Delhi and National Capital Territory of India. And therefore, I don't think he would be able to really capitalize on this entire episode. Plus, of course, given his personality and ability to make enemies, it is unlikely that once he is out on bail, all opposition would naturally welcome him with open arms. That won't happen.
Three political prominent leaders are arrested at this point. Central agencies are used for political means. If BJP comes in the power for the third term, what do you see for the democracy in India?
See, in normal circumstances, when a party is repeatedly coming to power, one would expect that the party feels more secure and therefore less vindictive. It goes about doing its other agenda, whatever its social program, economic program may be. Somebody may like that program, somebody may not like that program, but the party continues with that when it comes to power. In the case of the BJP, over the last 10 years, what we find is that compared to its first term, during its second term, when it came to power with a higher majority, it actually became more assertive, more aggressive, and more intrusive in private lives as well as in the functioning of opposition parties. Therefore, if it comes for the third time in power, I think it would give a signal that the party in power would be less interested in procedures, norms, and constitutional proprieties, and more in settling scores, instilling fear, and creating overall an atmosphere which is not suitable for democracy.
And the way opposition parties are reacting to these arrests, Soren, Kejriwal, Kavita, so will it create any pressure on the current government?
No, I don't think so. One, that is because the ruling party is not really some party that would take pressure from the opposition in the first place. But the opposition is in such a situation that they are not even able to hit the streets, mobilize the people. Even after the arrest of one chief minister, no mobilization could take place because it seems that the opposition does not have the capacity to convince the people that something wrong is happening. So I don't think that nominal statements by opposition leaders today would have much impact on the course of choices that the BJP makes.
So, sir, in your opinion, what should opposition do to utilize this arrest for their political agenda or campaign?
It's difficult to say, as I said, because there is a trust deficit. Opposition doesn't enjoy the trust of large sections of the population. And therefore, to utilize such moments is very difficult for them. It is difficult also because if in this case they exploit this situation, they would be charged as colluding with a corrupt party or a corrupt chief minister. So you would be seen as siding with the corrupt or accused of corruption. And that would be a charge which the opposition would definitely like to avoid. Therefore, I don't think they would be very actively opposing it. The third way they can deal with this is probably to go to the people and try to convince them that this issue is an issue to deflect attention from the core issues of corruption from the ruling party, such as the question of electoral bonds. But you see, these are really very delicate and technical matters, and opposition party would require much more political skills to really handle situations like this.
How much of an impact do you see the controversy over electoral bonds having for the BJP?
The media is playing it out as all parties getting advantage or disadvantage from electoral bonds, or the media is simply reporting who bought bonds of what amount. It's not that point. The point is whether these bonds were bought in exchange of any quid pro quo. That is to say, if certain policies were designed to the advantage of those who were buying those bonds, or as is alleged in some cases, were the bonds bought under duress? That is, various investigating agencies knock at your doors, and then to avoid harassment, you buy bonds. So whether this is happening through coercion or through a process of quid pro quo is something that is still shrouded in mystery. We don't know the details yet. The opposition also has not been able to pinpoint anything very specific to the BJP as yet. And therefore, unfortunately for the opposition, though the electoral bond issue has come up at the time of elections, the opposition has been unable to convert it into an electoral issue.
BJP is using ED, BJP is filing cases and using central agencies. But common people are asking that because these leaders have indulged in certain kind of malpractices and therefore there is this force used against them. So do you think that being non-corrupt is possible and then to fight with BJP by ethical manner?
The first answer to your question would be yes, it's a challenge for an opposition, particularly when they are facing a semi-authoritarian regime. And that challenge is that the opposition itself has to be both democratic and transparent in its dealings. Having said this, and you and I can say this very easily because we are not in the business of politics, but the point is that political funding, not just in India, anywhere, is such a complicated and difficult issue that whichever way you try to handle political funding, there would always be problems in creating political funds for contesting elections and running a political party. And therefore, the debate actually should move to that larger question of how to finance politics and therefore how to organize democratic political parties in the first place. These are larger issues. Obviously, one cannot discuss them just on the eve of elections and then forget about those. They are long-term issues, not just in our democracy. Japan has faced this question. United States keeps facing this question again and again. And the trouble is that often it is the political parties, when they come to power as powerful politicians or opposition politicians, who have to legislate on this. That is where the catch lies, that after all, this entire question is to be legislated by the parliaments, legislatures, and not judges, not election commissioners, not police. So, it is a funny situation in a way that the legislators, who themselves might find it difficult to raise enough funding for their elections, will then sit and do a fair job of regulating political finance. That is why I said that a national debate on how to finance politics is required, and that may take time, but the caveat there is that to happen that, you need to have free politics in the first place. You cannot have opposition leaders under arrest and then say that let us have a national debate on political funding. That cannot happen.
You know, you pointed out that the opposition would like to avoid being seen as corrupt if they support these leaders. We are also in a time where the opposition doesn't want to be seen as many things. They don't want to be seen as pro-minority. So what is an ideology then for a opposition party to go for? Because everything seems to be a minefield that they can't step into.
Yes, that is something which typically happens when you have a dominant party system. And you would recall historically when Congress was the dominant party, this precisely was the predicament of the opposition that time. And one had to then wait for the Congress to implode. And only then a new political system could arise. You will find that on the question of economy, the opposition seems to be sort of in a dilemma always, whether to go for the middle classes or to go for the support of the lower half of the social order. They are not clear about it. And all of them are not on the same page about it. When the Congress talks of the lower half, some other parties sort of believe that this might not be a good strategy. So that's one area where they need to get their act together, or they should have gotten their act together much earlier by now. The other is the question of communication. It's not just your identity. Whether you are a pro-Hindu party or an anti-Hindu party, so-called, the question is how do you communicate with your voters on questions of identity and questions of culture. You will find that the Congress initially thought, the so-called famous Antony report for example, they thought that their ultra-secular position was hurting them. And therefore, they suddenly started showcasing themselves as devout Hindus. And I thought that was a mistake, because it was not a question whether you are a devout Hindu or I am a devout Christian or whatever. The Hindutva as a capsule of ideas includes religious identity, but it is identity more than faith. That distinction is easy to be made in principle, that there is a distinction between faith and identity, Congress could not do it in strategic and tactical manners in order to talk to the people. And therefore, I call it a communication problem for the Congress party, for other parties also, but particularly for the Congress party. So I think these are the two issues that haunt the opposition. One is their fascination for the middle classes rather than the lower half of the society, and their failure in the field of communicating with the people that in a sense hurts them the most.
We're back in conversation with Professor Suhas Palshikar about what the arrest of Arvind Kejriwal tells us about the challenges facing India's opposition parties. We spoke with Professor Palshikar about what the functioning of the BJP and the Narendra Modi government hints at for the future, and why comparisons with the Indira Gandhi Congress government of the 1970s aren't very accurate.
From Rafael to electoral bonds, no topic worked for the opposition against the BJP in India. Has BJP successfully created an image of a party with difference?
I wouldn't say that, but I would say that the BJP has been successful in handling moments of crisis. Whether Rafael or demonetization or electoral bonds, whatever, the BJP has the capacity to handle these things and to control public opinion. One reason it can control public opinion is because there seems to be a very wide range of trust that the people still continue to have in the leadership of Mr. Narendra Modi. As a result of that, he and his party are able to say that these are all false allegations, don't look at them, we are doing something good for you, focus on that, or focus on 2047 for that matter. This kind of skill and repository of skill with the BJP helps the BJP to insulate itself from such attacks. Then there is an external side to it, which is that all through this 10 years period, the BJP has been successful in getting enough support from the media to the extent of deflecting the agenda or the discourse. As a result of which, these issues do not really go to the public, or the public is not necessarily fully acquainted with the details of these issues. No media house would really say that we have found out this and therefore you should look at this. That is not happening. This collusion of media with the ruling party is something new to India. This didn't happen certainly in the past 25 years. And before that, during Indira Gandhi's time, the media was never so important or so pertinent to shaping of the public discourse. That is where the success of the BJP today lies.
And will such arrest make one party, one leader, one nation narrative stronger in coming days?
In a sense, yes, but I don't see that as a very important issue right now, because it is not about leadership. It is about discrediting all other political parties. Once you have discredited all other political parties, then the ruling party automatically gets an advantage in any electoral contest. And that is what is precisely happening currently.
In that case, can we call Kejriwal's arrest a backsliding of Indian democracy?
In isolated situation, I would have said that this doesn't matter, because after all, it is possible that political funding being such a delicate issue, parties do indulge in malpractices and so on and so forth. But if you look at the sequence of events, then it seems that we are somewhere on the slippery slope of democracy rather than going up. See, 1990s and 2000s were seen as the health of India's democracy because many more people were participating in the political process. Having done that, now we suddenly find that there is a personalization of authority, and therefore, though elections take place, those elections produce a result which certifies, mandates authoritarian politics. So if today the BJP argues that this arrest is something that the people of India approve of, then we find that there is a backsliding, not in terms of violation of procedures, but also shaping of the public discourse more generally.
Since you mentioned about the last 25 years of Indian politics, I wanted to discuss Indira Gandhi's political regime here. India has seen Indira Gandhi's government and emergency imposed by her, or a vendetta politics. What difference do you see in today's authoritarian regime in comparison to Indira Gandhi's politics?
Let us first look at the very dramatic part of that difference, which is that when elections were announced by Indira Gandhi, and she was not obliged to announce elections that time because she had already changed the constitution and extended the life of Lok Sabha. Anyway, when elections were announced in 1977, what she does is to release all detainees from prison so that then they could participate in the election campaigns. Today we find that when elections are announced, the government seems to be arresting a sitting chief minister of all the persons, and of course K. Kavita in the case of the Bharat Rashtra Samiti. So there seems to be some reverse operating here. Secondly, in the case of Indira Gandhi, while definitely the announcement of emergency was violation of the constitutional morality that we talk about, there still was a larger framework within which she operated, and she didn't dare violate that framework fully. She wanted probably to assert her authority, no doubt, and definitely therefore whatever happened during emergency was reprehensible, but to hide behind that or to compare today's happenings with only the emergency might be an inadequate comparison.
If we look at global picture, say Russia or China, where elections have become a farce, opposition is weakened or finished, does India risk becoming a democratic autocracy?
Well, it is something to be observed over the next 10 years perhaps. At this moment, we are almost on the verge of becoming a weak electoral democracy. There would still be elections, and we fortunately, I hope we won't be like our neighboring country, where an important opposition party was practically excluded from participating officially as a party. We hope that that doesn't happen in India. And if that doesn't happen, then in spite of these limitations that we are talking about, people would still have a choice not to vote a particular party or leader back to power. That possibility is there. On the other hand, if we continue with violating procedures, we continue with violating the norms that allow opposition to function fairly, then we would definitely be slipping into that unknown area where we don't know whether we are an electoral democracy or an electoral autocracy.
And you have written India is not even meeting minimal standards of democracy. Do you see the vibrant voters of today who are, facing a lot of advertisements on different platforms are aware of this fact?
I think that's the complicated question that we are facing today. That objectively speaking, one finds many problems in the functioning of the regime. But the regime actually functions in such a skillful and sophisticated manner that many voters simply remain somewhat less aware or less sensitive of these violations. Theoretically speaking, this division that people often make, that there is a distinction between liberalism and democracy, is problematic. And once you make that division, people would say that, okay, we will vote whomever we like, that is democracy. And then after getting elected, that whoever may function in whatever way, and that may be illiberal. There is an obvious contradiction in this. People need to be fully informed of the liberal and non-liberal ways of our rulers. And that kind of discourse at the time of elections should ideally happen. If that happens, then we probably may still have a vibrant democracy. Otherwise, putting the burden on the voter, that you are the voter, so you choose. I don't know whether this leader is good or bad. is not an adequate way of analyzing politics or understanding politics. We also need to tell the voter what are the choices, what they signify, what they mean, and what they have in store for the voter. All these things constitute a free democratic election. If that happens, then only the voter will be in a position to take that burden of making informed choices. If you recall, the entire electoral bonds ruling is based on this idea that there should be ability for the voter to make informed choices. Just my freedom to go and click the button in front of any particular candidate or party is not enough. Behind that, there is a long process that goes on in my mind, in my family, in my society around me, and that constitutes my act of voting.
Also, with the BJP, one major thing is this promise of economic growth, which is a major thing. Like you hinted at, like this, look at 2047, not even 2030. We are looking at a future that many of us may not even see. Is that a motivating thing enough to keep a party and an ideology and everything together? Because I'm coming at the fact that you mentioned how Indira Gandhi kind of faced a natural pulls from within her own party. But is this sort of dream enough to keep even a principal party together for that longer period? And does it, is it cohesive enough in that sense?
2047 is a dream, and dreams are always abstract. So you will find that they are very convenient to deflect attention from the present. I think that is a big risk that the BJP is taking, because it means that you are not talking about the present. And at some point, the voter may get fed up with dreams and ask you questions about the present. The second part of the risk is that internally, the BJP itself will find that this dream doesn't mean much, and they have to deal with actual programs and aspirations of their own leaders and supporters. After all, if you are getting support from 35 or 38% people, means that one in every three is voting you. They are not voting you obviously for 2047. They are voting you for today and tomorrow. And that today and tomorrow, with the difficulties that we are facing in our economy today, is a big challenge for the BJP. They are trying to offset that challenge by big dreams and the popularity of the leader. These are their two, in a sense, strong points currently. How long that will continue is really something that we don't know, and the BJP also probably doesn't know about.
We've seen this sort of alliances that the BJP has attempted to stitch together, which it could also cite as being signs of the fact that it isn't this all-dominant party that we keep saying it is. It is that it's a party that has strength in North India but doesn't have strength, say, in Odisha, Tamil Nadu and other states. How much do you buy into, for one, the alliances that it has been reaching out for, and what are the larger implications of these alliances if it does come to power in this election as well?
You know, the short-term strategy for the BJP in having such alliances is to neutralize local factors in these states and particularly ensure that whoever wins there, they will support the party. That's the short term. But the long term, I guess, is to actually neutralize opposition more generally. That's a hegemonic project, as I would call it. And for that hegemonic project, it is necessary that other opposition parties are neutralized. They have already fairly demoralized the Congress party over the last 10 years. But if you look at the election results of 2019, you will find that there are states where state parties are quite strong and powerful. They may be pro-BJP or anti-BJP, but they are definitely standing their own ground. So how to then undermine these state-level players is the current plan of the BJP. In Maharashtra, for instance, they have already effected that plan by splitting two local or state level parties, and by that effectively neutralizing all region based opposition to them. The same has happened to Nitish Kumar. He may win seats or he may lose seats, that is immaterial. But Nitish Kumar as a force in Bihar is over because of his flip-flop over the last 5 years. Now is the turn of Navin Patnaik. Now is the turn of a likely contender in Andhra Pradesh, Chandrababu Naidu, and so on and so forth. So if you look at these states, East and South, you will find that they are doing these two things. One, either adding new allies or aggressively going for their 2047 dream of a Hindu Rashtra in Tamil Nadu and Kerala. Because these are two different things that Mr. Narendra Modi has been doing. On the one hand, they are buying peace, trying to buy peace at least with BJD in Odisha, and have got peace with Chandrababu Naidu. Whereas down south in Tamil Nadu and Kerala, they are attacking not only the local parties, but also attacking the idea of south being different, the idea of diversity. All these things are being attacked. So you will find that this is not just electoral politics. It is a larger politics of creating the hegemony of the BJP's ideology.
The BJP sort of deflects away from big issues of the day, that it sort of diverts you towards something else. But how do you view the fact that it's often just maybe silence, the fact that they don't say anything at all? And there is another alternate stream of communication which is more directly addressed to the voter rather than going through, say, even the existing media channels in that sense.
That is precisely the characteristic of what is known in political science as populist leadership. Always, not just in India, elsewhere also, and there have been many studies of populism and populist leadership in particular. One very central feature of populist leadership is to talk directly to the people. So there is a direct connect between the leader and the people, and actually it is the people, not voter. The leader and the people, or the leader and the follower, all intermediaries, whether it is the party or the media, are sort of pushed aside or accommodated. But the relationship is between the leader and the follower. And that leadership and follower-leader relationship, in a sense, deflects everything else. The leader comes and tells you that, look, don't worry about today. I am talking to you about 2047. And the trust level is such that people say that, yes, if the leader is saying so, then today must be a good present, and we are moving on to a better present. Indira Gandhi, though to a limited extent, did manifest these characteristics of populist leadership. After her death, we did not have a populist leadership at the All India level, but populist leadership did exist in Andhra Pradesh, in Tamil Nadu, and in the form of Kejriwal later, it emerged just around the same time that Modi's leadership emerges. There is always a craving in democracies for strong leaders. Because democracy is about negotiations, because democracy is about compromises, people in democracy always tend to like a strong leader who doesn't have to compromise and who says that I will take this on. Now, this image is not typical to Modi, it is typical to populist leadership. All over the world, this leadership, and there have been studies of populist leadership of the past in Latin America, of the present in Hungary or in Turkey, and so on and so forth. They tell us that democracy runs this risk, that you need a leader and you also need the capacity to control that leader. The moment the latter is weak, the leader grows and becomes overwhelming. We probably are at this moment, and there can be discussion endlessly on this question as to why this happens. I don't think there is anything peculiar in Indian psyche, therefore people are running after leader. It has also to do with our existential crisis, through which people then turn to tall leaders as saviors. We want saviors, after all, as citizens and as individuals, as groups. That savior always becomes overpowerful. We in 2010 entered into that phase, not because of Kejriwal or Anna Hazare, but probably because of many other political and economic processes that have happened over the last 25 years.
What happens when you have a populist leader for a very long time, and what happens when we don't have a populist leader after that?
normally scholarship on populism is unanimous on the point that populist leadership often endangers democracy. Secondly, scholarship generally shows that populist leaders can't solve problems precisely because they are populist. As I said, democracy is about negotiations and compromises. Populist leaders abhor compromises and negotiations, as a result of which, whenever there is a populist leadership, there is more confrontation in the societies. Internal confrontations emerge over a period of time. So, to answer your question, populist leadership often results into a situation of more crisis and more chaos.
And is there a balancing force that brings it back to a sort of equilibrium?
Very tough, because every society has to then invent its own balancing forces or counterbalances to populism. Another populist leader can never be a counterbalance to populism. And therefore, it's a tough battle between populist leader on the one hand and a more accommodating and more compromising political leadership or politics on the other hand. Usually, it takes the form of some kind of a coalition. A coalition that searches within to find out what are the cultural resources that we can then bring out to counter populism and this overbearing leadership. So finally, the answer is that we have to go inside us to find out the cultural resources. It's not the external ideological force or just economy that would help us fight populism.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh and Sahil Gupta. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on TOI Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, email us at toipodcast@timesinternet.in.